This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott. And have we got a great show for you tonight? No, we don't. Damn it! The phone is ringing again. It's the request line. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, East of the Rockies. Hey, breather, what's going on, man? You stared directly at the solar eclipse without ISO-compliant protective eyewear? Oh man, that's a terrible idea. You could have seriously damaged your eyes and even go blind. What do you mean anything that prevents you from seeing new episodes of our shitty podcast can't be all bad? Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on? It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine by REM. You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine by Georgia College Rockers REM. We'll get the show started after these very important messages from our sponsors.
What's up, music nerds? Are you tired of wading through a sea of mediocre music, desperately seeking to find a glimmer of greatness? You're in luck. My name is Mark, and I am the host of the podcast, Songs That Don't Suck. Each week, I scour the depths of new music playlists to unearth hidden gems that defy the trends and deliver pure sonic bliss. No matter the genre, if it doesn't suck, it's on my radar. So find us on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today. And as always, keep searching for and listening to Songs That Don't Suck.
Breaking news!
What is this garbage you're watching? I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter on the line, Rico Gnu, with the good news. How are you, sir?
Fucking awesome, dude. Coming off of the eclipse yesterday, we were in totality here in Northeast Ohio, and I don't know how you feel, but I thought it was pretty cool. I dig that kind of stuff, but it far exceeded my expectations. How about you?
Agree. I didn't give a shit about it, and but I eventually gave in because my wife said, you know, your kids are really into this, so maybe don't be such a dick. So I said, hey man, this eclipse, let's do it. But ultimately, work from home today because of traffic in the area. I did. So when it was eclipse time, I got up from my computer and I walked out in the backyard and I looked at it. Then I went back into my computer, went back to
Jesus. Lucky you. I, on the other hand, was in the office, and on my way home from the office, it was like leaving a concert at the Richfield Coliseum. It was like asses to elbows, like the entire way back home and every state route and highway outside of going out of Northeast Ohio was just not good. So I'm from that respect, I'm glad it's over. But the actual totality itself, like I was looking at it and I felt like I was hearing some like orchestration in the background. That's how amazing it was. It was just super fucking cool. I'm glad I got a chance, dude, once in a lifetime thing here. So it was pretty rad.
It's just like episode 122 of Rock and Roll Autopsy. It only happens once.
Exactly, and it far out exceeds your expectations once you give it a shot, right?
Oh my.
Okay, anyways, well, let's get this started. So, all right, I'm only going to spend 3 seconds on this. Okay, maybe five, but Kiss sold their brand and everything to Pop House Entertainment for $300 million. Congratulations, you're independently wealthy. I don't want to talk about it anymore, but what I do want to do, Scott, is I'm throwing it out there to the dudes at Pot of Thunder who I hope are listening. I want to talk Kiss and this $300 million with Pot of Thunder. So if word gets back to them, have them email us so that we can talk about this on an episode. You guys hit us up. We want to talk about this. Anyways, enough about that. I don't fucking care about Kiss. We've beaten them to death. But what I do care about, Scott, is Dee Snider. Can you remind everybody about how he's been very instrumental in discussing the music industry via, like, in front of Congress, and talk to us for a second about all of the good things that he's done for the music industry with regard to speaking out, if you will, for lack of a better way of putting that, and then we'll get to why we're bringing this up, as everybody should already know.
Well, listen, man, I mean, a quick second. I mean, Dee Snider should be a super credible kind of guy. You know, he sat before Congress during PMRC days and comported himself well and respectably, and is a pretty fine ambassador for rock and roll. He has some gravitas in the music community, believe it or not, fronting the ridiculous Twisted Sister somehow.
Right. And what was the thing that he said about going on tour when you're kind of past your prime? What did he say about that again? Do you remember?
Paraphrasing, he basically advised against it. He said, listen, know what your sell-by date is. Understand that the people who are buying a ticket are there for nostalgia. And if the band can't deliver on that, it's just a major bummer for those people in attendance who are reminded of their own mortality.
So then, is it okay that Dee Snider is publicly stating that the offers for Twisted Sister to get back together to go on tour are getting too hard to ignore?
Is it okay? Yeah, it's okay. People can evolve their opinions, and it's funny how money has a way of hurrying that evolution. But, you know, yeah, it's okay. I mean, you can say one thing and then years later say something else. It's okay. Listen, we live in a world where people are massaging truths all the time to kind of fit whatever their agenda or narrative is of the moment. So all Dee has to do is be honest and say, look, it's about the money. They're paying me enough to where I got to eat my words and get on the stage and sing, we're not going to take it one more time.
Yeah, I mean, and I think he is being honest about that, which is, I don't have, listen, here's the reality of this, and maybe you're a little more ensconced into their catalog than I am, but really, Scott, aren't people, when people buy tickets to see them, aren't they getting like 10 minutes worth of material that people really care about?
Yeah, they're gonna get I Wanna Rock. Is that what it's called? I Want to Rock.
I want to, yeah, something like that, right?
And then they're gonna get We're Not Gonna Take It, which is Oh Come All Ye Faithful, and then they're gonna get the song The Price, and that is, and maybe do they do Under the Blade? Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, you're talking 20 minutes worth of music, I think, that people know and recognize and care about. Rico, my problem with this, though, is I just struggle to believe that there's this pent-up market demand for Twisted Sister to hit the road. Who's buying these tickets? I don't get it. This is like with the Kiss thing. I mean, I don't know where the value is in whether it's the money to put Twisted Sister back on the road out of retirement or the $300 million for Kiss's shit. I don't know, man. Who's buying this stuff? Where?
Well, nobody. I don't. And that's what I'm struggling. Agree 100%. I'm struggling to see how there is a demand for Twisted Sister. Where is the demand for that?
Rico, it should be noted that while Kiss sold their catalog for $300 million, and I'm not trying to make you talk about something you put to bed.
No, it's fine.
But keep in mind, but this cycles back to the Twisted Sister thing. Kiss struggled to sell out their final two shows in New York City. Struggled to sell them out. They're a New York band in their hometown. Last two shows, Madison Square Garden. Last two shows ever, End of the Road Tour. Was not an easy ticket to move.
Well, and in reality, I was just kidding, by the way. We can talk about Kiss if you want to. But Pop House, see, here's the thing. Pop House could give a shit about rock and roll or Kiss's contribution to rock and roll. This is a business decision, and all they need to worry about is getting a return on investment. They need to make more than what they spent. And honestly, in my opinion, and this is why I want to talk to the guys from Pot of Thunder about this to get their opinion. I think what's going to wind up happening is Gene Simmons said, this is like, don't worry, guys, this is a collaborative effort. Well, that's going to go away in a hot second as soon as Pop House doesn't like one of Gene Simmons' ideas. And Pop House is going to say, listen, we own everything and we value your opinion, but ultimately we're going to do what we want to do. And ultimately this shit's going to flame out hard. And the big question is it going to flame out before they make their money back, or are they going to take a loss? That's going to be the big question.
Well, I think this cycles back to the Dee Snider conversation. Yep. Kiss held on too long and they're going to get away with it. It's Pop House that's going to take the hit on that. Had this sale been made 10, 12 years ago, then everybody who grew up listening to Kiss is 10, 12 years younger. And you know what I mean? And there isn't a lot of light ahead at the end of the tunnel here between people who Kiss fans are 50 plus years old. Okay. And they've already spent enough money in their lifetime on Kiss. I don't know what it is that Pop House is going to put on the table that's going to separate old ass men from their wallets one more time for Kiss. I don't know what that is. And there's no market for younger generations, none. So I don't know what it is.
You're absolutely right. And to go on what you were saying, if they had sold their catalog to Pop House even 10 years ago, Scott, just 10 years ago, they probably could have given Kiss another $100 million and still had a really great chance of making money on this, because they would have had 10 more years to make back that return on investment. See, now these fuckers are 74 years old. Their fan base is 74 years old. There's not a dude, and nobody under the age of probably what, 40, 45? I don't think people give a shit enough to pay $50 to go see cartoons. They're going to flame out. This is going to be a bad decision for Pop House. Ultimately, it's going to be hard for them to make their money back.
So, agreed. So, Dee Snider says there's demand for Twisted Sister.
I have no idea. Okay. Well, good on him. Like, if he can make a few bucks, then go for it. Like, good on him, right? At least he's being honest about it. You know, hey, I know what I said, but you know, money talks and it's hard to turn that down, right? Like the golfers that are moving from PGA to Live Tour and making zillions of dollars when nobody thinks it's really ethically appropriate to do that. But they're like, dude, like when they're writing $100 million checks, it's hard to pass that up, right?
Well, here's the crux of the biscuit with the Twisted Sister thing. If Dee Snider can deliver on stage, it doesn't matter, because what he's talking about are bands that are hanging on too long and still can't cut the mustard in a live performance. Yeah. If D can still sing, and I have a suspicion that he can, then they'll be fine and he won't have to eat his words. He'll be like, hey, I'm still delivering. It's the people up here with, you know, getting vocal assistance from a, pre-recorded track I'm talking about, right?
Oh, sure. As long as they can continue their kind of tongue-in-cheek approach to rock, and they've always had kind of a fun approach to rock. And as long as they can entertain the way that they did in the 80s, nobody's going to care. But it's going to be bad if they can't pull that off, to your point. All right. I want to do this. I got another little game for you. You ready for my game?
And those of all of you...
Dear listener out there can play along too with us if you'd like to. This is Scott. Can you match the real names of famous rockers? I can give you their stage name, and you tell me if you know their actual name, or I'll give the actual name and you can tell me who everybody knows them by. You choose.
Give me the actual name, and then I'll try to guess the stage name.
Sounds good. All right. So here we go. Number one, Saul Hudson. Saul Hudson.
That's Slash.
You got it. Slash. Guns N' Roses, man. All right. Here we go. Number two, Frank Farina Jr.
That is Nikki Sixx.
God damn. Two for two. Batting 1,000 so far. Oh, you're going to get this one. This one's easy. You ready? Vincent Damon Furnier.
That's Alice Cooper.
Yeah, man, you're on a roll so far. All right, here we go. You ready? Ready? Here we go. Number four, Steven Victor Tallarico.
Is that Steven Tyler?
Yeah.
That was a guess. That was the first one I didn't know.
That was good, though. That was a good guess. All right, here we go. William Bruce Bailey. You know this one.
That's W. Axl Rose.
Yes. Got it, man. Shit. Paul David Hewson.
Is that...
Yes.
Hold on. Is that Bono?
Yes, it is Bono. One of your secret favorite bands. I don't know if you're going to know this one or not. Olvi Aikimo. Does that sound? I don't even know who this is.
I don't know.
Abath Doom Occulta. Do you know who that is?
No idea. Is that some like black metal dude?
Some black metal guy.
Some Norwegian black metal dude. Yeah. No idea.
Me either. I'm sure somebody out there knows. Here we go. Brian Elwin Hayner Jr. Don't know if you know this one either.
Don't know.
Sinister Gates. Any idea who that is?
The lead singer, I think, of Avenged Sevenfold.
Oh, God. A7X for short, right?
Yes, sir.
You know this one. David Robert Jones.
Is that David Bowie?
Yes, a.k.a. Ziggy Stardust. Yeah. That's correct.
Davy Jones Locker, baby.
Right. Darren Arthur Reed.
Arthur Reed. Don't know.
Dizzy Reed. Any idea who that is?
Piano player for Guns N' Roses.
Oh, gotcha.
All the GNR guys have aliases. All of them. They could put them all on this list.
I don't know if I would have my real name in that band either.
Ouch.
Sebastian Philip Bjork. This one should be easy for you.
That's got to be Sebastian Bach, right?
Yes. Brett
Canada's Michael's own, baby.
Right, Canada. Love you, Canada. Brett Michael Sychak.
Oh, it's Brett Michaels.
Exactly.
Pennsylvania, Poison.
We got time for a couple more. Glenn Allen Anzalone.
Oh, that's Glenn Danzig.
Yeah.
A lot of Italians on this.
Where did he get Danzig from? Where do you think he got that from? Do you know?
It's a country, isn't it? It's like, I think he just yanked some, or is it a city? Is it a city in Poland or something?
Shit, I don't know.
I don't know.
Good question. Somebody out there help us out. Farouk Bulsara.
Is that Freddie Mercury?
Yep, you got it.
God damn.
Joan Marie Larkin.
Joan Marie, is that Joan Jett?
Yep. All right, one last one, and then we'll take a break. Robert James Ritchie.
Oh, that's Kid Rock.
Yes. Man, you did great.
Hold on.
Good job on you.
Ball with the ball, a bang, right? Remember?
Yeah, that might be an episode of ours in the future.
Dude, look at my nose real quick before we end. See that big red dot?
I see that. Yeah.
That's a giant, painful zit. You know, yesterday I went in front of the mirror in the bathroom and I saw what looked like a giant, like, hunk of, like, PVC piping, like, sticking out of my nose. It was huge. And it was the longest, like, blackest hair. And I just took, like, I just grabbed a razor and I just shaved it off real quick.
Holy shit.
Just in, like, a second. And now I've got this giant zit where it was, and it hurts.
You try to go like Dr. Pimple Popper on yourself.
But there was a big black hair sticking out of it. It was super unsightly. And I was like, it was so long. I'm like, how many days has that been there? And I didn't even notice it.
Ingrown hair, right?
Oh, fucking my nose is just, I look like I've been drinking. I've got like...
Dude. Like, you got wino nose.
To have wino nose.
Why didn't you look like a wino? Why didn't you take tweezers and just pull the hair out?
Well, I just did it like in a, I just wanted to do it like in a hurry, because then I got to find tweezers and they're.
But you had a razor laying around.
It was laying on the edge of the bathtub, so I just grabbed it. I was literally standing at the sink, and then my razor was laying on the lip of the bathtub, so I just picked it up and grabbed it and gave it a swipe. And then now I've got like this giant, like, look how ridiculous it looks. Like, I look like the guy who voiced Frosty the Snowman, Jimmy Durante.
You keep a razor by your bathtub in case you're having a real bad day, right?
No, it's like I usually shave in the shower. Shave my head in the shower, so I've always got a razor.
Gotcha. You don't go electric razor, you go like fucking straight razor.
I just do it in the shower. It's just easiest. Like, I'm already there. I don't have to clean the hair out of the sink. You know what I mean?
True. It's a good point, man. What do you shave every day? You shave your head?
Sometimes every other day. Just depends. If it gets itchy, I shave it. We got to go. The news is...
I know. All right. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk some Michael Stipe. Steeped in his own words. Michael Stipe. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Looking for a good rock and roll book? Do you watch a ton of rock and roll documentaries like I do? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, to be the place to go for previews, reviews, and recommendations of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies. Every first Tuesday of the month, the Rock Talk Studio gets you caught up on all the latest and points out where to go for the good stuff. Give me 20 minutes and I'll get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books, docs, and movies from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. Fan or just casual fan, or maybe you're on the fence and just looking for something new to check out. Either way, I got you covered. Recently on the show, I've talked about books and documentaries from everyone and everything from David Bowie, Randy Rhoads, and the Allman Brothers, to the Abbey Road Studios, Cheap Trick, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Little Richard, and more. Join me, Big Rick, every Tuesday of the month as I host the Rock Talk Studio podcast, the ultimate review of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies.
Our Mind on Music is a podcast that covers all things music. We cover all genres and we welcome all perspectives, from musicians, producers, and content creators to music enthusiasts. We have discussions, interviews, opinions, and much, much more. We hope you'll join us every week, Our Mind on Music, on YouTube and all streaming platforms.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues in the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted unto the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm, a sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage. And with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities. And with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace, in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
Hey, all of you listener out there, thanks for sticking with us. Very much appreciated. Now go grab somebody and make them fucking listen. I guarantee you it'll be their favorite time ever. Listen, Scott, we're going to talk, and everybody else out there, everybody is included. We're going to talk some REM, dude. This is their fifth album. The album's called Document. The song is It's the End of the World as We Know It. And I feel, Scott, I feel fine. I don't know how you feel. I feel fine. 1987, like I said. This is a Michael Stipe creation. Depending on which version you listen to, there's, you know, different links, but that doesn't really matter. Here, I gotta lay some ground rules first before we get to how we're going to determine if it killed rock. This is not graduate level poetry seminar where we apply critical theory to Michael Stipe's lyrics. We're not going to do that. We're assuming that you guys have already done that. We're not going to break it down for you. We're not going to overanalyze each syllable to see what he really meant here versus that. And we're not applying graduate critical theory to this. We're going to find out if it killed rock. So we're leaving it up to you guys. If you need to press pause, go press pause. Go do your homework, listen to the lyrics, go read some articles, and then come back and we'll tell you if it killed rock. So Scott, did it kill rock? I don't fucking know. That's why we're doing this.
Yeah. I mean, listen, that's why we're here. We are Rock and Roll Autopsy. We've got our lab coats on and our scalpels in hand, and we're ready to perform this autopsy. You know, if you haven't picked up on it, tonight's theme is somewhat, if there is a theme to tonight's show, between the solar eclipse and this song and the death of rock and roll, it's an apocalyptic theme tonight, Rico. This is all about the end times, okay?
True.
I never really wanted to exit this world with a giant zit on my nose, but you know, I would have hoped that at least I could have been looking as good as possible in my final moments, but nonetheless, it is what it is, right?
Well, you have a freshly shaved dome, so that more than makes up for the wino nose that you currently are sporting. So don't worry about it. You're good.
You know, it's awful because the older I get, the bigger my nose gets. And sometimes I just catch a glimpse of it in the mirror and I'm like, holy hell, I'm to a point now where I'm pretty much all nose.
Well, isn't that what they say? Your nose and your feet never stop growing. And your ears, right?
And your ears, yeah.
And your you're gonna be able to, can you touch your tongue to your nose? Because you'll soon be able to. At some point, it's going to grow to that point. So that's something you have to look forward to.
All right, gang. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. The band is REM. The album is Documents. And we got to find out if it killed rock and roll. So, dear listener, you're probably wondering, just how do these two simpletons pull this off? Well, the fact is we cheat. We use science. But as proprietary, we came up with it. So there's that. And it consists of five categories. They are gratuitous boomerism, excessive misogyny, wanton whiteness, malignant machismo, and culture vulturism. You know, the podcast might suck, Rico, but it's ours.
That's right, baby.
All right, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. REM, the category is gratuitous boomerism. Rico, what say you?
Okay, so there's nothing wrong with speaking your mind, right? There's nothing wrong with trying to express when you have a problem with the way things are being handled from a big picture government slash world perspective, I suppose. But do we still do that nowadays? I feel like quote unquote protest songs, which is kind of what this is, I feel like protest songs are not really translating to nowadays. I don't see many people doing protest songs like this one. Yeah, I'm, and especially when this protest song was coming right on the heels of the Iran-Contra scandal, which is a super boomer thing that we won't even get into right now. That's a whole nother thing. So yeah, because of all of that, this is a big one for me for gratuitous boomerism.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because a part of me wondered, you know, we've kind of been through it, you know, as a country, and certainly like as a people, as a world, as a planet, really, the past, like, I don't know, half decade or whatever, you know, the global pandemic, all this stuff, we got wars in Europe, the whole nine yards, right? There's just been a lot of shit that's gone on. And for a minute, I told my wife, I said, well, you know, if nothing else, we'll get some good music out of this, because we always, like, historically, like, if you go back to the 1960s, right, Vietnam, assassinations, you know, the draft, you got some fucking great, great, great topical music out of all of that, right?
Right.
So I can remember at one time sitting there as the world was burning around us, and I looked at my lovely wife and I said, at least we'll get some good music out of it. And then WAP came along. Much to my chagrin, we got Bupkis, we got nothing. Okay, so yeah, so
I mean,
apparently
I never thought of
songs,
it that way.
Apparently protest songs are a boomer thing, because we got nothing. No one apparently had anything to say about anything that was going on in the world of interest. It just, whatever,
what
we got
happened?
Phones.
I mean, it's you know, you, dude, that is such a good point, man. Like, political world strife, countries having issues with each other, the economy sucking, that has produced some really great music in past decades. It's gone now. Where is it? That's supposed to be the kind of shit that inspires really great music, but it's not now. And that's a good point, man. That is a really good point.
Well, we still have the old timers writing about that stuff, but it hasn't necessarily come from the next people up. So I'm going to give it, for gratuitous boomerism, for the records, we can do our due diligence here. Michael Stipe, age 64, born in 1960, boomer, the excellent guitar player, Peter Buck in REM, born in 56, age 67. So these gentlemen are boomers. It's a boomer track, yes. And kind of loosely based off of, you know, Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick, you know, blues. So another boomer influence, as I have many times in this podcast contended that I consider Bob Dylan to be the ultimate boomer artist. I'm going to go ahead and score it a 0.5. Not going to go full one. I'm going to go 0.5 for gratuitous boomerism. Rico, the next category is excessive misogyny for REM. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. And as much as I'm going to regret saying this, I have the lyrics available if you'd like me to attempt to read them.
If you feel confident that you can handle this. This is a pretty tall task. Loosen yourself up a little bit. All right. Right. Let her rip.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes and aeroplanes, and Lenny Bruce is not afraid. Eye of a hurricane, listen to yourself churn. World serves its own needs. Don't misserve your own needs. Speed it up a notch, speed grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with a fear of height, down height. Wire and a fire represent the seven games and a government for hire and a combat site. Left her wasn't coming in a hurry with the Furies breathing down your neck. Team by team, reporters baffled, trumped, tethered, cropped. Look at that low plane. Fine then. Uh-oh, overflow, population, common group. But it'll do. Save yourself. Serve yourself. World serves its own needs. Listen to your heart bleed. Tell me with the rapture and the reverent and the right. Your vitriolic, patriotic, slam, fight, burn light, feeling pretty psyched. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine. Go ahead, take your glasses off and stare into the sun. No, that was not a part of the lyric. I added that Eclipse reference at the end. There you go, Rico. A little bit of the
well
lyrics.
Done. Well done. Well done. Anytime you mention Lenny Bruce, Leonard Bernstein, and Leonid Brezhnev, that just reinforces my boomer score. Just want to get that out of the way. Having said that, let's not make any mistakes about these lyrics. Like, for if you aren't really focused enough or paying attention or whatever, you might think that just is just a bunch of gobbledygook, right? That this is just a like a free write. Like if you remember in writing class or poetry class, it could be easily construed as free writing, right? That it's just a bunch of gibberish. I dare say, though, what is written, these lyrics, in my opinion, are very smartly written. They're every word is very meticulously placed. Everything has a purpose. We're not going to break it down. This isn't critical theory class, but one could easily, Scott, I'm telling you, I have a little bit of exposure to this, as you know, with graduate level literature and stuff like that. And I can tell you that you could easily talk about this song in a graduate level poetry seminar. You could. It's that well done. However, clearly there's no this is Michael Stipe, dude. Like, I don't think you could pay him enough money to be misogynistic. He's really, 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 really far left liberal. So there's no fucking way. Like, the world would literally end if he even tried to be misogynistic about something. So the score is going to be a hard zero for me on this one. But yeah, don't think that this is nonsense, that these lyrics are nonsense, because they're definitely not, guys. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I would score it a zero as well. And yeah, Michael Stipe is obviously the last man you would ever find any misogynistic references in his lyrics. In keeping with our, since we're talking about lyrics, and in keeping with our apocalyptic, unintended theme tonight, this song was included on the 2001 Clear Channel Memorandum of songs thought to be lyrically questionable after the September 11th terrorist attacks. Have you ever heard of this thing, Rico?
I have not. Do you care to expound it a little bit?
Yeah, well, it is exactly as it sounds. Clear Channel, that's that one company that owns like every freaking radio station after the 1996 yep. Telecommunications Act. They issued a memorandum of songs that basically should not be played any longer in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. And it's kind of an interesting list. They gave this list out to the radio stations that were under their purview and said, hey, let's not play these lyrically questionable songs. Isn't it funny how when the shit hits the fan, the reaction is often like censorship? Isn't that weird how that kind of thing happens? But at any rate, I digress. You want to hear some of these songs?
Yeah, dude.
Here are just a snippet of tracks. There's many. I won't list them all, but the list of songs on the Clear Channel memorandum, of which this REM song, It's the End of the World as We Know It, is one. Three Doors Down, Duck and Run. Can't play it.
Okay.
311, Down. Don't play Down. Might trigger people. AC/DC has half their catalog on this list. Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap, Hell's Bells, Highway to Hell, Safe in New York City, Shoot the Thrill, Shot Down in Flames, and TNT.
Jesus Christ.
Alice in Chains, Down in a Hole, Rooster, Sea of Sorrow, and Them Bones. Alien Ant Farm's cover of Smooth Criminal.
What?
The Animals, We Gotta Get Out of This Place. This one is curious. Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World. I guess not so much anymore. Bad Company, No Smoke Without Fire. The Bengals, Walk Like an Egyptian, was ruled lyrically questionable following the 2011 terrorist attacks. Beastie Boys, Sabotage, and Sure Shots. The Beatles found themselves in the crosshairs with A Day in the Life, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Obladee Oblada, and Ticket to Ride. Pat Benatar, Hit Me with Your Best Shot, and Love is a Battlefield. The list goes on. Boston's Smokin'. Let's scroll down, dude. Dio's Holy Diver. Foo Fighters, Learn to Fly, lyrically questionable following the... Guns N' Roses, Knocking on Heaven's Door, lyrically questionable following the terrorist attacks in 9/11. Judas Priest, Some Heads Are Gonna Roll. You can no longer play that. Lenny Kravitz, Fly Away. Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. John Lennon's Imagine. Jerry Lee Lewis's Great Balls of Fire. Let's see, did Rush make the list? REM, The End of the World as We Know It. The Rolling Stones, Ruby Tuesday, made the list. Anyway, I digress, so I won't go any further. Oh, Bruce Springsteen, I'm Going Down, I'm on Fire, and War. Wow.
I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around what I just heard. Like, that's unbelievable. If that's not like some suit in Washington, okay, we had a catastrophe, now let's just lay the hammer down and just censor everything because that's what we really want to do. I'm baffled, dude. I'm really glad that didn't take hold, because clearly that didn't take hold. But I'm just stunned that somebody even thought that was okay to do that in the first place.
So here's Clear Channel says, the Clear Channel memorandum contains songs that in their titles or lyrics vaguely refer to open subjects intertwined with the September 11 attacks, such as airplanes, collisions, death, conflict, violence, explosions, the month of September in New York City, as well as general concepts that could be connected to aspects of the attacks, such as the sky falling or weapons. Also included in the ban were several happy and celebratory songs, famously including Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World, as Clear Channel believed playing joyful music in the aftermath of the attacks was inappropriate.
Oh my God.
Anyway, so that's a little bit of a digression, but super interesting and fits with the unintended theme of the night. Rico, let's move on. Category 3, Wanton Whiteness. It's the End of the World as We Know It, REM.
I mean, as much as I try to find something not white about this song, I can't. I'm sorry. It's Michael Stipe. Michael Stipe is probably the whitest person on the planet. Quite possibly. So for me, there's nothing really else needs to be said about this. It's a white ass song sung by a white ass dude. So it's going to get a one for me.
Yeah. And this is, I agree. This is a solid one. Listen, I love REM. I'm not like super duper, you know, well-versed in their catalog. I have a few of their albums. I have Green. I have Automatic for the People. I love the Monster album, which no one else liked. And I love this song. I think it's a great, great track. But I will be the first person to admit that this is one of the whitest bands in rock and roll. This is the, any band that is thought of as the, that they are the ones who basically invented college rock. I mean, You know, this is one of the whitest bands ever. Super jangly guitars. I don't know, man.
Hey, do you? Let me ask you something. This was their fifth album in 1987, okay? So they probably did their first one in, what, 82, 83, probably somewhere around there.
Sure.
Do you think these guys were, like, 8 to 10 years too soon? Do you think they would have done way better if they were in the 90s?
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, definitely kind of like an early 90s band, right? I mean,
yeah.
And I think of the jangly Peter Buck guitars. I mean, they were certainly super influential on all those bands. I mean, it was alternative rock in the 80s. You know, there was Depeche Mode and The Cure and Love and Rockets and all that stuff. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff. But REM sound specifically is very much 90s alternative rock, you know. And I took a walk today because the weather was nice, and you know, I just wanted to take my last walk because it was the end of the world and all. And I listened to this record while taking a walk, and I was thinking it still holds up. It sounds pretty freaking modern, you know.
Yep. And I feel like this album in particular, I haven't listened to the other ones. This one in particular may have, and maybe the other ones too, would have fit into that post grunge era that I'm so fond of, because I think this would have gone way better in that time period than the time period that it actually was in. So I feel like they were a little too early.
We, of course, have a local Northeast Ohio connection to this song, because in 1992, remember the radio station 107.9 The End? They played this song famously on a loop for 24 straight hours to introduce the new radio station at the time in Cleveland. And it also says here on Wikipedia, now I'm just reading Wikipedia, so that's what kind of great content you get here on Rock and Roll Autopsy. You could never do this yourself. Says that amid the global COVID-19 pandemic, the song received an increase in downloads and streaming in March of 2020. People love to wallow in it, man.
Boy, oh boy.
All right, so let's move on. I'm giving it a one for once in whiteness. Let's move on, Rico. Category four, malignant machismo from that macho man himself. What are we tapping on?
Sorry. That was my brain thinking, actually.
Oh my gosh, I thought somebody was at the door. Well, they can come on in and hear the rest of the podcast. Malignant Machismo, It's the End of the World as We Know It. Rico, what say you?
So, there, as we've talked in the past with regard to this category, sometimes there are different versions of malignant machismo. You know, there's the Jim Morrison malignant machismo. There's the Hetfield stance that we've talked about a lot. You know, in this song with Michael Stipe, I'm going to give it a full one. And here's why I'm giving it a full one, because he's being a fucking Karen. And when somebody's being a Karen, they get a full one from me on that. And all he's just bitching and whining like a Karen, and that's okay, but it's still getting a one for me. So I give him a full one for being a Karen.
Wow, those are fighting words, man. So you're saying this is just a bitchy rant, and it was uncalled for, and he embarrassed himself in a Walmart.
Well, bitchy rant, but a well-written, well-executed. I will tell you, I do like the song a lot, and I will never, ever, ever complain about how he executed the lyrics. I think that the lyrics are elite level writing. However, it's still a bitchy Karen rant, in my opinion. So I'm going to give it a one. Science.
All right, man. Well, I don't know if I'm going to come out on that side of it. I don't know. I'm thinking that, you know, I like the End of the World. I'm going to come out pro End of the World. Just let me just go ahead and step out.
I wouldn't expect anything else other than that from you, Scott.
Yeah, I'm just going to kind of step out on a cliff here and just kind of put myself out there and just say that in general, I have always been fascinated by and have kind of been secretly rooting for the End of the World. You know, my favorite book by Stephen King is The Stand. I've read it multiple times, always disappointed by the television adaptations, but the book is amazing. And the book is just an apocalyptic fantasy about the end of the world. And I like to take myself and insert myself with those characters. I think, wow, it would be so sweet if instead of 8 billion people on the planet, there were only a few hundred thousand. As long as I'm among one of them, I'm all for it. So
exactly.
So I kind of like it. And I look at this song as like, listen, I think it's kind of like, in a way, it's sarcastic. And I think it's celebrating the end of the world in a way. And I'm cool with that. I like cynicism. I like sarcasm. I like, there's a little bit of wit, I think, about it. And so
a lot of wit, in my opinion,
a lot of wit. And I like that kind of, so if it's macho in the sense that it's got this cocky arrogance to its celebratory, somewhat funny take on the end of the world, then maybe I would go ahead and give it like just a soft 0.5 for Malignant Machismo. Very soft, Rico.
Yeah, I all kidding aside, I think I'll roll back my score to a 0.5 also.
But I'm a big fan of the end of the world, man. And it's,
you know what? You're not the first person to talk about The Stand. It's a guy I work with. We've done a podcast with them before. He like 2 days ago thought I was absolutely insane that I haven't read that book. And he's like, you won't be have a complete life if you don't read that book. So it's funny you mentioned that.
Well, there's two versions. There's the original 1970s version, which was like 800 pages, because I think he turned into his publisher this like 1500 page book, and they said, whoa, young Stephen King, you are a new writer and don't have the gravitas to put out a 1500 page book. You're gonna have to cut this fucker in half. And so he gave him an 800 page book, and they were like, good, we'll put this out. And then sometime in the 80s, when he became like the Stephen King we know today, he then put out his uncut The Stand. I've read them both. I've read that book multiple times. I love that book. I think it's terrific. And if you've ever like watched the, there were two TV adaptations, one that was on, I want to say, was it Paramount, Rico, last year? No, it was not last year. It came out around the pandemic times, and people were kind of questioning its timing. And then there was one in the 90s with Gary Sinise and Molly.
I remember that. I didn't watch it, but I remember it being on. It was like a made for TV deal.
Yeah. And it's like, it's just funny to me that with today's like budgets, and we have constant like series that run like 5 years or whatever, like Breaking Bad and shit, why they can't make this into like, give it the character depth and the nuance that it deserves, and just make it like a 5-6 year series instead of always trying to make it some kind of fucking 4-episode mini series. Why are they doing that? I don't know, but we'll never see another one, at least for another 25 years since they just did one. So
probably not.
Anyway,
unfortunately,
I agree with you. Do you like Stephen King?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I like him. I've never read any of his books, but I would. I mean, I like that style of fiction. I know he's kind of slow, and he kind of plods along a little bit and sets things up, and he's very meticulous. And I'm not against that. And I'm not against reading 1500 page books either, because I've done that before. I just have never, you know, everybody's got a giant list of books that they want to read. And mine's huge. And there's a shitload of Stephen King on there. And it's just like one of those things where I just have never gotten around to it. My own fault.
Dude, there was a window of time in my life where I had read every Stephen King novel. You know, you could look at the front of the book and it would have like the list of everything that he's written. And I'd be like, yep, read them all. And then it got to be about the 90s, around the time I think he was doing The Dark Tower. And I fell off. And then now I tried to get back on again a couple of years ago. And there's been like 100 books between then and now. And I'm like, fuck it. I ain't ever getting back on.
Right.
You know, it's like,
I hear the Richard. I hear the Richard Bachman stuff is really great.
Yeah, I've got that's his alias. He did the one book that had like, remember the Running Man movie with Schwarzenegger came out of that one. And then he had another one called the Regulators. That's a Bachman book. I actually have that one. Pretty good. But I don't know, man. It's, listen, I don't have time to read anymore. And people that keep buying me books. I don't know if it's just because I'm like middle aged now, but when I get a gift, people give me a book and I'm like, I don't need any more books. I'm behind as it is.
Well, that's what old people do. They read books with their readers on.
All right, man, let's move on. Culture, yeah. Vulturism, REM, apocalyptic rock and roll autopsy tonight. It's the end of the world as we know it. Rico, what say you?
See, you mentioned it before, Subterranean Homesick Blues. I feel like that's a blatant ripoff of that song, and it just kind of repackaged a little bit. I even tried to find it. I was listening to this podcast that was breaking down the sea. I did my fucking homework with this song because you kind of have to. Michael Stipe actually played Bob Dylan in a movie or something that he did. And so because of that, I feel like this song is way more than a casual reference to Subterranean Homesick Blues. I think it's like 1.0 on the culture vulturism scale for me because of that. I think it's really way too close for my liking. Although, again, I love this song. The lyrics are crazy how talented he is with regard to lyric writing. But I think it's a little too close to Subterranean Homesick Blues for me. It's going to get a 1.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 0.5. There were a couple tracks at this time. I think NXS had a track called, what was it called? Mediate?
Need You Tonight.
Yeah, Need You Tonight / Mediate. Yep. That was like, remember the video with the signs?
Love it.
It was just, it's a great song. Love it. But it was just, it was Subterranean Homesick.
True.
It's like,
how big of an NXS fan are you? You like them?
Yeah, I actually really love them. I just listened to the...
Me too.
Yeah, I was into them in the 80s, and I still listen to them now. I just listened to it a couple days ago, actually. But
that one, the what's the name?
The Kick Off.
That really bluesy song on there with the saxophone solo.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about.
Every track on that record is a single. I mean, if you go back,
it's so fucking good, man. Anyway,
all right, man. I'm giving it a 0.5 for culture vulturism. I don't see a lot here. I mean, I think REM kind of have their own sound. They are the kind of the inventors of college rock, early alternative rock, way ahead of the curve for what was to come in the 90s.
Yep.
I'm going to give them a 0.5 for culture vulturism.
Fair enough.
Just a smidge because of the, you know, it's okay to borrow a little bit from your influences. So I'm not going to go full chub on that.
They did invent a subgenre of music. That's true. Good point.
All right, man. You ready to tally this thing up?
Let's do it.
All right. Let's see. So I've got 2.5, Rico. I've got 2.5.
And I've got 3.5.
Ooh. For a grand total of
6.0. Close. Wow. Close. Almost. But didn't kill rock. Clearly the science once again does its job.
You know, I gotta ask you, man.
Yeah.
As I week after week, we're kind of knocking these songs out, and I look at the age of like Peter Buck and Michael Stipe, and these guys are like, they're straight up boomers, man. These are older cats, and I don't think I was ever like aware of the dominance of boomerism in my life growing up until I started doing this podcast.
Yeah,
I think my life's been shaped by boomers, man.
All of our lives were shaped by boomers.
Yeah,
that's a fact. Yeah,
I think
especially our musical lives, because and boomers are still running the show because they're the ones that are still going out on tour, selling out like fucking. It's a mystery to me how they're selling tickets to our previous conversation about that. But yeah, dude, like boomers invented this thing that we talk about every week, more or less. And we were all shaped by their will, if you want to put it in those terms. So yeah, that's a good point.
And from I love the music. So in a way, it's like, thank you for the great art, boomers. We kind of make fun of you every week, but thank you. I actually love the art you gave the world.
Aren't they very dichotomous from a certain perspective, Scott, where they're totally boomers and get off my lawn, but damn, they have created some really great art over the decades, whether it be visual art or music or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Which kind of contradicts their really bad attitudes, very, very narrow bad attitudes, which is kind of weird, right?
I think it's the fate of every generation too. And the older I get, the more I kind of realize that when you're younger, you're just scratching and clawing for respect and no one will give it to you. Then when you get older, you think I should have respect now, but then you see people younger than you disrespecting you and people older than you keeping you in your place. And then when you're finally at the top, you're just old and now no one really wants to listen to you. So I think you basically go through your entire life without ever really kind of like being where you want to be. And I think that we are, as Gen Xers, we're heading into that place right now. We're going to replace the boomers soon. And we will be the ones that everyone will be pointing at and saying, you left us a shit fucking world. What were you doing? Why weren't you paying attention? That finger is going to come at our faces here very shortly. All the shit the boomers are getting, we're going to get. It's all going to be on us next. So true, we're never going to sit at the top of the mountain and be like, yeah. And then everybody will look at us and like fan us with fig leaves and feed us grapes. It's never going to happen.
No, as much villains. As we wanted to. That's true. That's okay, though. I don't mind being a villain.
Rico, you either die a hero or live long enough to become the villain.
I mean, as long as I'm remembered, I guess that's the main thing, right?
Oh my God. All right, we got to go, gang. This has been Rock and Roll Autopsy. Good night now.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
You guys, it was like a mistake. There's no mystique anymore.
To the dawn, love it till the morning. I'm gone.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com. And if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Before you go, if you like heavy metal and stories, then you'll love Battle of the Bands, the narrative form metal podcast that unpacks the biggest rivalries in rock and metal history. Season 1 took in Megadeth versus Metallica. And Season 2 went across the divide to explore the beef between Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. It's like Business Wars, but metal. Find Battle of the Bands wherever you listen to your podcasts, or visit battleofthebandspod.com.